From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 4 years out, who will bring justice for residents of Flint?
In a bureaucracy, it seems like when something is like everybody's fault, it's nobody's fault.
Two journalists talk about lessons for accountability and public health. Also on the show, the state of Michigan files suit against some of the biggest names in corporate America. The target? PFAS that leached into cities' water. We'll also hear how a similar case went in Minnesota. And Jeff Daniels joins us. The actor, director, and writer is fresh off a Broadway run of To Kill a Mockingbird. He'll talk about 30 years of original productions at Chelsea's Purple Rose Theater.
After almost 30 years, what keeps me going is that I can put up what we do. You could drop it in Chicago, you drop it in New York, LA, and we would more than hold our own.
Daniels is back at the Purple Rose with a new original show. That's coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Thanks for joining us today. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking about what happened in Flint 4 years ago when Attorney General Bill Schuette announced a criminal investigation. To date, no one has served a day in jail. With time running out to hold anyone accountable, we'll check in on where things stand. But first, as you've been hearing in the newscast today, the state of Michigan is suing 17 defendants seeking damages for widespread PFAS contamination. PFAS, of course, is a class of toxic chemicals, also known as forever chemicals, because they take millions of years to break down in the environment. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody joins us with the lowdown. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
Tell us about who the state is suing. Who are the defendants in this case?
The defendants in this case are companies that produced PFAS chemicals as part of their production of various products, various consumer products and others. And it includes some of the biggest names in American industry, like 3M and DuPont, as well as a lot of other smaller companies that the average person wouldn't know offhand.
What does the suit claim?
The suit claims that these companies were aware of the dangers that PFAS presented to human health and to the environment, and knew it for many years, but didn't disclose that information, in part to protect their bottom lines.
The lawsuit was filed in Washtenaw County Circuit Court on Tuesday, right?
That is correct.
What's happened since then? Have the defendants said anything about these charges?
I've talked to a couple of different representatives from different companies. DuPont, they say that this suit has no merit whatsoever, and they say that they are not involved in any kind of production involving PFAS chemicals. Now, 3M has also criticized the lawsuit. They insist that they have done their best to release this information and to show that, you know, what they knew and when they knew it. There is some question, though, about how forthcoming 3M has been through this process.
And what is the state seeking if the suit's successful?
Well, the state is seeking financial damages from these companies to help with the cleanup of these chemicals. There currently are about 74 sites around the state where PFAS contamination has been documented. And it costs the state about $25 million a year to identify these sites and to get a sense of their size. But the cleanup of these sites is going to cost much, much more money. And so at this point, it's not exactly clear what the state hopes to get, but it probably would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. As an example of what another state has done, 3M and the state of Minnesota reached a settlement of litigation there where 3M agreed to pay the state of Minnesota $850 million. Now, it's not exactly an apples and oranges comparison between what the state of Michigan has filed and what the state of Minnesota had filed, but that's an example of what the state of Michigan might be looking at in this lawsuit.
Steve, thanks very much for the update.
You're welcome.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. It was 4 years ago today when the state of Michigan made it known there would be consequences for what happened in Flint. State Attorney General Bill Schuette at that time announced a criminal investigation against more than a dozen people involved in water and in the cover-up of Flint's water crisis. Here he is later that spring.
They failed in their responsibilities to protect the health and safety of families of Flint. They failed Michigan families. Indeed, they failed us all, and I don't care where you live.
Last summer, under a new state AG, all those charges were dropped. And today, Flint residents like Claire McClinton are asking what happened.
Here we sit, 4 years from the initial announcement of charges. We are just sitting up here with no one being held accountable, on top of the fact that we have received no, zero, nada compensation for the damages that were done to our health and our homes.
The city of Flint's disastrous attempt to create a new regional water system has touched countless people's lives and health, including developing children who may never know life at full physical and mental capacity. And the conversation about public health and the position of cities in American life that captured the nation's attention feels oddly unresolved. With us to look back and hopefully forward are Ron Fonger, a reporter for the Flint Journal and MLive who covered the water crisis, and journalist Anna Clark, author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
Thank you.
I want to ask you both, you were there in a city where folks were experiencing very immediate health problems, and the city was in a complete tumult in terms of its administration. If someone had asked you 4 years ago where we would be today, what would you have said?
I remember being there at the time that the Attorney General came forward and announced that he was launching his investigation into what happened with the water in Flint. And I don't think anyone thought that 4 years later, we still wouldn't have had any criminal cases, you know, get beyond the district court level or with plea deals. If this was a standard police investigation, I think we're inching into the territory where it's becoming a cold case almost.
Anna, what is there anything we can say that Flint has done for national attention to water quality?
Well, it has certainly elevated it to a completely new place, and I think it's been in a very long time, since maybe when we were designing drinking water systems in the first place. There's a lot of unresolved questions about what Flint's legacy is going to be, but I think one positive thing that we can truly say is that there are communities all over the country that are reckoning with their water quality in a new way. I think have been looking towards people in Flint as a kind of blueprint for how to have agency, you know, when it comes to decisions about their water quality, how their water is delivered, equity and environmental justice, access to affordable, healthy drinking water, and infrastructure. I mean, there are cities that are replacing lead pipes. This was not on their radar before Flint. So that is a positive legacy, though, of course, you know, the critical piece of accountability, I think that is something that is just still on the table.
While the criminal case has been stalled since state prosecutors dropped those charges last summer, there were some things that the city enacted. First of all, Ron, can you tell us a little bit about what the litigation has cost taxpayers over the past 4 years?
Just the criminal cases, tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
And there were 15 people who were originally charged with crimes related to the water crisis. They were all former state or city employees or emergency managers who worked in Flint. And they were all provided attorneys to defend them in the lead up to their cases and as they went through the court system or were resolved with plea agreements. Even some people who were never charged with crimes, the former head of the Department of Environmental Quality, for instance, his attorney's bills that state taxpayers paid for amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars, even though he was never charged with a crime.
Right. We continue to talk about Flint as a public health crisis, but I've sort of come to think of it as a crisis of public administration. Anna, you wrote in The Poison City about a civil engineer named Mark Edwards who played a role in investigating Flint. And you relayed a question that he had about what are we loyal to in this world? Are we loyal to our friends and our employers or to a truth to humankind? And that every scientist and engineer has to decide not once, but throughout their careers, how they're going to answer that question. How do you describe the fundamental tension that kept the people who knew about the problems from either speaking out or from being heard sooner?
I think that's one of the things that's really unnerving about what happened in Flint and part of why it caught so much attention. I mean, because, you know, I mean, this isn't a case where, you know, you have some anonymous corporate company like blinded by profits and poisoning water. You know, I mean, the folks with the power to make decisions that caused and prolonged this crisis are generally, you know, folks who went into the public sector. They're working at the Department of the, you know, the environmental agency or a health agency that theoretically they got in there because they want to make the world a better place. They want to help people. So, like, how do we get to a point where you have this sort of cascading series of poor decisions that resulted in actual harm to actual lives? And I think, you know, one of the haunting pieces that the unresolved accountability issue is like sending is that in a bureaucracy, it seems like when something is like everybody's fault, it's nobody's fault. That's the message that's being delivered. And I think that should be a cause for alarm, not just for the folks in Flint, but for all of us.
Ron, what did you learn about what it takes for people to speak out in a situation like this?
These folks, by and large, that have been charged with crimes related to the water crisis, you know, these are crimes of inaction, I guess. They failed to act when they were in a position to stop this long before it was stopped. So unlike a lot of other criminal investigations in that, you know, you're looking for a motive, and in a lot of these cases, what we had was people who were not concerned enough about the public health of the people of Flint that they stood up and said, wait a minute, this is messed up. Our use of the Flint River and trying to treat that water and get it into homes and deliver a safe product is not working. And there were numerous people who knew that or had very strong suspicions of that, and whether it was spread of bacteria, whether it was the elevated levels of lead that were coming through the tap. I think that's probably what's made pressing these charges a little more difficult than the standard case.
As we mentioned, the prosecutions that were announced 4 years ago have completely fallen through. Do you, either of you, foresee a continued effort to try to bring some justice for the residents of Flint? Ron, have you heard anything?
We're hearing very little out of the Attorney General's office right now. That is by design. They don't want to talk about their investigation other than that they are pursuing it. Only they know for sure what the future of any criminal charges related to this are. But they are, at least on charges of misconduct, they are running up against a clicking time clock here, because the statute of limitations for misconduct by a public official is only 6 years in Michigan. And April 25th will be 6 years since the switch of Flint's water source.
Ron Fonger is a reporter for the Flint Journal and MLive. We've also been hearing from journalist Anna Clark. She's the author of The Poison City, Flint's Water, and the American Urban Tragedy. We're going to have more for you on water and public health just after a break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As you heard just a few minutes ago, one of Michigan's efforts to crack down on water pollution is a massive lawsuit announced late yesterday against large corporations like DuPont and 3M, companies that used chemicals known as PFAS in their processes. The state of Minnesota has been down a similar road, trying to hold manufacturers accountable for their use of PFAS. The suit in question in that case targeted the company 3M. Kirsty Marone is a reporter covering water issues for Minnesota Public Radio News, and she has been on the beat for ongoing lawsuits. She joins us now from Minnesota. Hey, Kirsty, how are you doing?
I'm good.
So in 2018, Minnesota settled its case against 3M. Can you remind us what that lawsuit claimed?
Sure. Well, the state of Minnesota claimed that 3M produced these PFAS chemicals, actually the two most well-known, PFOA and PFOS, for decades, for about 50 years. And for a couple of decades, they were disposing of waste that contained the PFAS in unlined landfills in the East Twin Cities metro. And during that time, the chemicals got into the groundwater and some surface waters, including the Mississippi. And they say that this contamination plume extended over like 100 square miles, so a pretty large area, affected the drinking water of about 150,000 residents, and that the company should be held responsible for that.
And so in the settlement, the state had been seeking $5 billion, but 8 years later ultimately settled for this much lower sum of $850 million. Do you know why the attorney general at the time, Lori Swanson, chose not to pursue it any further?
Well, you know, this case had dragged on for so long. It was 8 years. It had gone back and forth. There were delays. There was actually a delay of a couple of years while they argued over whether the law firm that the state was using should be allowed to represent Minnesota because it had previously represented 3M, and 3M claimed that was a conflict of interest. So it was just a lot of delays, and I think there was just a sense that the state attorney general and others felt like getting some kind of settlement was better than nothing, better than just the case continuing to drag on. Also, you know, we had quite a few communities that their drinking water had been impacted. They were looking for to get some resolution here and a long-term solution. And so Lori Swanson, the attorney general at the time, she said that she felt like this was a good settlement, that it was a win for Minnesota, and that this money was real money that could be used to help provide clean drinking water for those communities.
Do you have any sense of what the cost of the lawsuit had been to the state up to that point?
I don't know if anybody's tried to to try to calculate that. I mean, it did drag on for so long.
Years, that, you know, yeah.
Years, right. And, you know, just the staff time and everything, attorney's fees. I do know that of the $850 million settlement, what actually ended up being available to the state was about $720 million, which, you know, some lawmakers were not too happy about that.
How come? What was the attorney? Was the rest of it court costs?
Attorney's fees and other expenses. So, you know, took a chunk off the top right away. And then, you know, there's just been a lot of discussion over whether that sum of money, I mean, it's a lot of money, but is it really enough to, you know, to really address the scope of the contamination here?
How did the state figure out how to spend the $720 million that it did see for cleanup out of the lawsuit?
Well, that's still being determined. The state created some advisory groups that are working on trying to develop a plan for how to do that. The settlement did have a couple of priorities. Number one was the drinking water for these affected communities. So there's about 14 different communities, cities involved here, and you know the solutions might look different for each of the cities. And in some cases, they might be building a new water treatment plant. In some cases, they might be bringing residents who have contaminated private wells onto city water systems. So it's just really a long, complicated process to try to figure out what that's going to look like for each of these different cities, and then to try to come up with a plan that everybody agrees on. That's the tricky part, of course.
Do you have a sense of how much agency the cities or other local water authorities might have? I mean, these are big decisions that are going to affect their water systems for years to come.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the cities do have input in the process. The state ultimately, I think, will decide, you know, what happens. But the cities definitely have opinions. You know, in some cases, they've spent a lot of money on their own water treatment systems. So the idea of, you know, suddenly having to abandon all that infrastructure and hook up into a regional water treatment plant or something is not always that appealing to them. But, you know, the residents are able to kind of weigh in here. There's going to be some public input meetings once the plan does get rolled out. And the state, you know, has said that they will try to defer to what the cities and the residents want to do if they can.
Right. Would you say, Kirstie, that Minnesotans feel satisfied with how all this got resolved? Would they have any advice for Michigan being just on the cusp of a lawsuit that may run along similar lines?
That's a really good question. I think you're going to find a lot of mixed opinions. I think, you know, in some cases, people think it's a good thing that 3M was held accountable here and is having to pay for some of the costs of this contamination. The people I talked to in the areas that were affected, there's a lot of concern still about their drinking water and the effect of these chemicals. You know, 3M already was paying for bottled water or water filters for the residents who had wells that were contaminated. But there's still a lot of fear, a lot of concern for people wondering, you know, whether if they were drinking this water for a long time, if their health was affected or the health of their family members, and, you know, kind of what the future is going to look like. And I think part of that concern is that, you know, we haven't really settled on what the safe drinking water level is for these chemicals. So Minnesota in 2017 actually lowered its health-based values for PFOA and PFOS. So suddenly, some cities that thought that they were okay, their drinking water supplies were okay, suddenly found that their wells had to be, they had to stop using some of their city wells because they had levels above the, you know, levels of PFAS above the safe limit. So I think there's still just kind of an unsettled feeling with a lot of these people just wondering what the impact is and what the future is going to look like.
I wonder if you can give us any context for the 3M lawsuit in the bigger picture of Minnesota's map of contaminants. But I think that's just about all the time that we have. Kirsty, your stories have been a real resource. Thank you so much, and thanks for your time today.
You're welcome, April.
That's Minnesota Public Radio's reporter, Kirsty Marone. You know, it would be so easy for Jeff Daniels. 84 screen credits to his name, a successful theater in Chelsea in Southeast Michigan. He also performs to crowds of adoring fans as a touring musician. And since we last spoke with him, he had a starring role as Atticus Finch on Broadway that won rave reviews. I mean, does a guy like that really have to keep on keeping it interesting? Fortunately for us, Jeff Daniels does not do coasting. And he stopped in recently to speak with us about recent work. Can we start talking for just a minute about your work on the 2018-29 production of To Kill a Mockingbird?
Absolutely.
This was an adaptation written by Aaron Sorkin, of The West Wing, of course. It was praised for not falling back on the much-beloved literary classic that we all know, and instead making Atticus Finch a bit less immediately heroic. He had to find his way into doing the right thing. What did you notice about how audiences reacted to the show?
It was fascinating because I was in the show for a year. And the different waves of audiences that would come through. Initially, when the curtain first went up on those first 10 or so shows, you could feel the audience who had read the book because they brought the book. And they were holding the book, like the Bible, against their chest. And out I come, and I'm not Gregory Peck. I knew he wasn't going to be. I was open to it, but now I can see it, and I'm trying really hard. That was initially. And then we would get him. We'd pull him in. Because Sorkin moved things around. He was able to write some scenes that aren't in the book. That aren't in the movie, like when Atticus goes to the jail and meets Tom Robinson. That's in the first 15 minutes of the play. And so things like that threw them off, but that we were certainly faithful to what Harper might have written, but we were doing what Sorkin was going to do. And it allowed us to do something different with Atticus, which was, in the movie, he's Mount Rushmore. It's an 8-year-old's point of view looking up at Atticus Finch. And Peck played him that way, and it was written that way. In the play, Scout is late 20s, talking to the audience about what happened to her 20 years ago. And so we go back, and we see from her point of view, being older, Atticus go from being a simple small-town lawyer who handles land disputes, service agreements, and foreclosures, and can write a will. Those are the things he does. That's it. And he's trying to raise his two kids. And then the judge comes over one day and says, I got this criminal case I think you should take because it's a slam dunk. And he takes it. And then his life is changed.
The way we see our parents as adults is so radically different.
Yeah. And that's where Sorkin went. So you see Atticus Finch become Atticus Finch in the play. And by doing that, and all the other things that Sorkin and Bart Shearer, the director, did, and the cast, we like to say you watch the movie, you read the book, you feel the play. Audiences were knocked out by it. And they had even the ones who knew the book and knew the movie.
You're a pretty fearless person. You've played roles that are on every point of the continuum of audience sympathy, but was it at all scary to try to take on such a beloved character in such a different way?
Yeah, it had risk and failure written all over it. Did Gregory Peck give the definitive performance? Was he the definitive Atticus Finch? Or was he the only guy who got to do it? And I have to take the latter. Or I can't walk on stage. You can't walk on stage worrying about Gregory Peck. So you have to hit the delete button. And he doesn't exist anymore because you're originating the role. And in a way you are, because he didn't play it this way. It wasn't this script. And we're not doing Horton Foote screenplay on stage. And so it is an originate. I am originating the role. And so that you have to, especially on Broadway, especially in front of the critics, walk out there and challenge them. It took me decades to learn that. But you have to do the work, you have to prepare, you have to be disciplined, you have to outwork everyone else. Then you have earned the right to walk out there and the critics are in the audience on opening night or whenever, and write almost, you turn to them and go, keep up.
We've benefited from decades of your stage performances now. Why do you feel so strongly, as someone who's got this huge film repertoire as well, about maintaining a career in live theater?
There's nothing like it. Movies are moments. Shooting movies are just grabbing little moments here and there that someone else is going to put together in about 3 months. And that scene or that speech that you did isn't in the movie anymore. You have more control of your art when you're standing on stage in front of 1,400 people at Schubert Theater and you're doing the closing argument from To Kill a Mockingbird. It's you. You have complete control. You're directed. It is written. But you're the one who executes it. And there is something to be said for all the actors who went to Broadway, who went through the theater, who know what it means to go 8 shows a week for a year. Henry Fonda did it in Mr. Roberts. People like Lee J. Cobb did it, Jason Robards, Alec Guinness, Olivier. The greats did it. So I don't think you can be a great actor unless you're also a great theater actor. Because I know I've done both. And you can't get away with as much on stage. In fact, you can't get away with much of anything. But you can be terrible on film, and they just cut it.
The theater that you founded in Chelsea, Purple Rose, has been producing new work since 1991. When I realized that's how long it's been going on, the first thing I thought of, you're talking about a theater operating on the mandate of bringing people the classics they don't know yet. The first thing I thought of was, what has it been like to keep it going?
You don't keep something like this going without the help of a great board of directors, with supporters and donors, because we are the sole reason for us to be a nonprofit is so that the price is as affordable as possible. Said a guy who just came from Broadway where it was $200 a ticket. Can't do that. Theater won't survive at that price. And it's simply a price point on Broadway because people will pay it. And I got this at Circle Rep in New York. We have nothing if there is no connection between what's going on stage and the audience. You have to have a connection. And I think we've made that connection. And we know how to develop plays. It's just the shark's got to keep swimming, you know. The creative part of me, it's just got to keep going. And it's the same with all of those people. It's what's the next play? What's the next thing we're doing? It's this act of creation that is keeping me going. And I think it's connected with this audience. I think there's an audience that understands that what we're doing at the Purple Rose isn't like anything else. And that after almost 30 years, what keeps me going is that I can put up what we do. You could drop it in Chicago. You'd drop it in New York, L.A. And we would more than hold our own.
Well, I know how beloved it is within theater circles just because there's been so much of what has kept playwrights going over the past decade or so is their side work in TV. And yeah. Just having a home for something that is original work is so rare. It's interesting that you feel the audience growth has gone along side by side with that.
They trust us now. They don't come. Initially, in the first 10 years or so, they came just because there might be a chance I might be in the lobby. That's okay. Whatever gets you in the door. But now they're coming to see what the Purple Rose is doing next. That thrills me.
My guest is actor, director, and writer Jeff Daniels. More from him after a break. You know, while we've got you here, can I talk to you about how we talk to you? We really love your input on the show. Have you ever wanted to talk to somebody like Jeff Daniels? What would you ask him? What are your ongoing concerns about water safety, for that matter? Or maybe you have things that you want to address this election year for your district, for Michigan, or for the country. Fastest way to reach us is on the social media. Feel free to follow me on Twitter. I'm at April Bear, or you can follow Michigan Radio on Facebook. That's a place where we often post about upcoming segments. You can shoot us some questions for future guests, suggest some interesting people you know that you think we should talk to, or just tell us what you want to hear about on future shows. That's at April Bear, B-A-E-R, on Twitter, or Michigan Radio on Facebook. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Bear. We're talking today with Jeff Daniels. In addition to the many, many films he's worked on, including The Martian, The Squid and the Whale, and Pleasantville, he created Chelsea's Purple Rose Theater, which produces original works for the stage. This week, Purple Rose is premiering a new play that Daniels wrote himself, focusing on someone who was very important in his life and professional development. The newest production is Road Signs, which you wrote. And the play starts in a small club with 50-something folk singer Lanny Wilson telling the story of how the song that people are hearing came to be. We should explain that Lanny is sort of the avatar for the playwright and your close friend, Lanford Wilson. And then the play takes the audience along on a bus ride with Wilson the teenager, going inside his mind as he encounters interesting characters. I think I misspoke. You co-wrote this play with your son, Ben, didn't you?
Well, I wrote the play. Ben and I wrote the music.
Okay. What was your approach?
1978, I was doing, I think it was 5th of July, and John Hogan, who's another actor at Circle Rep, he and I were sitting in the dressing room off-Broadway, playing guitars, writing songs. We're in our early 20s. Songs are horrible. I look up, there's Lanford Wilson, who would go on to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. Saying, and he said to me, he goes, you write songs? I said, yes. He goes, let me help. And he handed me a poem. It was about a bus trip he took from Missouri up to Chicago when he was a young man. And it was just full of the imagery and those people, those forgotten people that he wrote about in all his plays. And so I put some music to it and, you know, played it on the guitar and he liked it and we kind of had it and that was our little thing that we had and Hogan got a song. He gave Hogan a song. And it wasn't until after, you know, 25, 30 years of Purple Rose and I said, I think maybe there's a play in Road Signs. And it became this very personal journey for me. It's a tribute to the artist, the American artist. It's a tribute to those folk singers who come to the Ark or would love to get to the Ark. And they rent the car and they hit five clubs and sometimes they play to 18 people and they're great. It's a tribute to the songwriters who never get to see the light because they can't really sing as well as Garth Brooks or something. It's a tribute to all those artists. And it's the story of how he wrote the song. And you see this guy. And if we can pull it off, it's that you're in this guy's imagination as he creates these people who are on the bus. And then by the end of it, there's this song called Road Signs, and all these people are alive and walking around and singing right in front of you. It's unlike anything we've ever done at the Purple Rose.
She says, me, my sister, we strut our stuff. Those Motown jivers, they got nothing on us. I'm a singer. My.
As Lanford Wilson was writing so movingly about people and situations on the margin, he wasn't a writer who was just interested in quirky characters for the sake of quirk. You know, there was a depth of character study there. How did he affect your view of story and character?
He was always able to find heart in his plays, but he got there on the back roads of that character. He got there in ways that, as you look at story structure, and this is what I loved about Lamford the most. You go to Hollywood and there's a formula to do the story, and how to write a screenplay. And on page 29, this has to happen. And on page 59, it's just like a mathematical formula, story structure. And it really starts to smell like formula when you watch and they don't really write around it. Mm-hmm. Lanford would not only write around it, he would move it around and confuse you so you don't quite know where you are and all of a sudden you just got a right hook. That was his brilliance, the way he hid structure with the imagery that seemingly only he could have written it this way. But, you know, that's what the true artists do. You can't imagine anyone else doing it.
What would you say his relationship meant to you?
He found
his friendship, I should say. Sorry.
Yeah, well, he was a true artist, as was Marshall W. Mason, the artistic director of Circle Rep. But Lanford just clicked with me more because I didn't want to be a director. I wanted to be a writer. And so I just was fascinated by his process. And I learned at his feet about writing plays, about writing, period, about what matters, about don't sell out, about be an artist. I mean, I remember talking to Lanford when he was hurting for money. And I said, doctor a screenplay, for God's sake. They're offering you $100,000 to be the third writer on a movie no one's going to know that you were even on. Take it. Nope. I'm a playwright. Movies are bupkis, which is his way of saying I'm an artist.
I can't help but think about the trajectory of your own career. You've worked with so many amazing directors over the years and done movies that people would consider lighter, as well as fortified yourself with all your stage work over the years. What is your approach to making the work that you want to do while doing the things that you must do?
I've kind of arrived at it. Once you've done Atticus Finch on Broadway, there is no, you are at the top of the mountain. I remember in the show, just during the run of that, and he's going, this is not the gig that you call your agent and say, get me something better. There is nothing better than Atticus Finch on Broadway and with those reviews and those audiences. So now it really is, what do you want to do? And the things, and that's different for everybody, but for me, it's I want to continue to be challenged as an actor. That's why I'm doing this. I'm doing James Comey. I'm playing Comey in the James Comey. He wrote a book called Higher Loyalty, and we're shooting that right now.
A four-part CBS original series.
CBS or Showtime. I don't think they know yet, but they're excited about it. But I went into that going, I don't know how to do this.
In what sense? You don't know?
I don't know how to do this.
James Comey?
Yeah. And we start in 2 weeks. Now, I'd been reading on him. I'd been listening to the voice. But to go from a character like Atticus Finch that after a year, 415 performances, you could write a dissertation on him to someone where you're guessing, that's jumping off the cliff and flapping your arms and hoping you fly. And that, for an actor, at this point, for me, is exciting.
See, it seems to me we can argue whether or not Jim Comey was serving some kind of self-interest in coming mm-hmm. forward the way he did, but it seems to me there's not that much of a jump between Atticus Finch trying to find his way through to doing the right thing and Jim Comey being in this total bind of American politics.
Yeah, their commonalities were that they both believed in the rule of law and doing the right thing. I mean, they have that in common. And they're not the only two guys who think like that. You can go down the list of those people who came into the hearings in the House. Ivanovich, Taylor, Fiona Hill, for God's sake. These are apolitical people who are there to do the right thing, follow the law wherever it may lead.
And career people within their fields.
Yes, but apolitical. And they're aware of left and right, and they are aware of the consequences, and they have to follow the facts, and this is what the law says you have to do right now.
It sounds like you've been diving in pretty deeply on the testimony and other aspects related to Comey's story.
Yeah, you're going to grad school on James Comey, yeah.
Anything you learned? I mean, we've all been sort of hanging on the edge of our seats for the past 4 years on some of these events. But was there anything that stood out to you, either about him or about this moment in politics?
It wasn't everything he did was thought out and discussed with a team. He did have final say. He struggled with every one of those decisions. He had the choice between really, really bad and catastrophic. And you have to choose one of those. You can't not, and doing nothing is one of them in some cases. So just finding out about that and kind of just as an actor, your job isn't to judge him or to make you think that he's good or to make you think that he's bad. It's to just show you what he was thinking. That's all we're doing. We want you to know what he's thinking, his struggle, and why he did what he did. And yes, everything blew up when he did it.
You're working opposite Brendan Gleeson for this production, who's got the role of Donald Trump. I wonder how he's going about that aspect of the role.
We just want to show you what and this is also from Comey's point of view. It is from his book. So Trump will be Trump, and everything that Brendan says is taken from Trump's mouth. He said everything that he says.
But colored through Comey's perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the interesting thing for me about Comey, even in his relationship with Trump, but also with other people, is that some people said Comey was, you know, he was right, he had a higher sense of loyalty, a higher sense of truth, just like Atticus Finch, and yes, it was the right thing to do. Then others say he was self-righteous. Others say he was self-interested. So it's been fun to thread the needle on moments where he was either seeing a higher truth or he was being self-righteous, a little bit above you. My truth is better than your truth. And so it's been fun to kind of at least present a gray area in some of those moments where people can go, which is it?
How are you feeling about the possibility for doing interesting work in the environment that we find ourselves in now, where there are still traditional model studio movies, but so many on-demand productions popping up? I mean, you're in a place, as you say, where you can choose a little bit more. But is there anything that you feel is available to writers and directors and actors on this landscape that maybe wasn't there 30 years ago?
The reason I'm still in the business is because of pay TV, the Netflixes, the Hulus, the HBOs, the Showtimes, Amazons, on and on and on. It is a wild west for actors, right, and particularly for writers. I've found that in the ones I've done, Newsroom, Looming Tower, Godless, they're like novels. We're shooting novels, and we get to play 10 chapters. And especially if it's a limited series, then you've got a three-act structure, a beginning, middle, and an end. But you have 10 hours of it, not just an hour, 2 hours or less, so it can fit into a movie theater's time schedule. You get to shoot the whole novel. And for actors, for writers, that's just, it's kind of great. And there's so much content, which is, you keep wondering for it all. It just kind of, you know, there's just too much out there. And then we get to the world where nobody's watching anything.
I don't think we're there yet.
I don't think we are either. But there, it's niche marketing. Like Godless was a movie that we did for Netflix, and Scott Frank was the writer director. It was a 2-hour western. He tried to get it made at a movie studio for 15 years. Nobody wanted to do westerns. And then Netflix appeared, and now Netflix said, "Yeah, we'll meet on that." And take your 2-hour script. Could you make it 6 hours, maybe 7? Then we'll do it. For a writer?
My arm.
That's how Godless happened. And now we're shooting it on Netflix. And he gets to spread the story out. Not just the A story, but also supporting characters that in the movie kind of just pushed the plot and then went away. Now they have beginning, middles, and ends. And there becomes this layered fabric of story that if you've ever read a good book – will pull you in just like that. for me, it was all about the beard.
Yeah. A case where the facial hair kind of does the work.
He did.
Work
Scott
for you.
Said, I see the guy with a little bit of a stubble, kind of like Henry Fonda in that Italian Western that I can't remember. And I said, yeah, okay, like a quarter inch. Yeah, okay. It was June. And I showed up in September with that. And then he goes, keep it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with actor, playwright, and musician Jeff Daniels. As if all this weren't enough, you have maintained a life on stage playing in a band with your son, Ben. I believe managed by your son, Lucas, when you're on the road. Yeah. What is the live music experience like for you these days?
I really enjoy it. It allows me to do what I can't do on stage as an actor, is to deviate from the script. I love the aliveness of it. There are certainly things that are set up, written almost after many performances, but there are other times where I just veer off. And it's fun, it's exciting, it's very present. And I get to control everything, especially if I'm solo. I'm the writer, the director, the actor, the editor. I'm everything. And I like that, because in my other parts of my life, those jobs are handed over to others. And I like the freedom that comes with that.
What kind of bars do you guys play?
Bars?
Excuse me. What kind of theatrical venues does the band play?
I played bars.
Yeah.
I played a bar in Montana that was really – I love Missoula, Montana. We love it. It's a great night.
What are you looking for in an ideal venue for the band?
I like places like the Arc. I like the Listening Rooms. We tour the Northeast. They've got a lot of places like the Arc. Cafe Lena was fun just for the history of it in upstate New York. I like to go to the offbeat places like Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And they've got an opera house, not like the Michigan Theater, but pretty good. And they put $1 million renovation. It's their town jewel. And you show up and, yeah, maybe they're coming because of Dumb and Dumber or Newsroom, but you pack the place. And then all you got to do is play and make sure they have a great time and drop in some of the stuff that you enjoy. And next thing you know, they've had a great night. And constantly we would play, and after the show, people would come up and go, thank you for coming here. Most people don't.
It sounds kind of amazing to see America through the lens of small-ish towns that have really made the effort to keep their main streets alive and have some place for people to come play.
Just the opera houses. The opera houses all over this country. I'm whenever Jim Fleming, who's my musical agent, he says, it's an opera house. It's in God knows where, Idaho. I'm interested.
Forgive me for not knowing this, but do you guys have any road dates this winter?
There are no dates right now. No, I'm
you're working.
Yeah. I'm going to do the Comey thing till the end of February, and then I start something else with the guys who wrote Looming Tower, Danny Futterman and Adam Rapp. We're going to do a series for Showtime starting in March that'll take me into the summer.
Jeff Daniels, a real pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, April.
Road Signs, written by Jeff Daniels, opens at the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea this week. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Skahn. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.